considering Putin's actions in Syria. From a historian's perspective, to what extent was Obama's 2013 red line disillusion a green light, in effect, for Putin's actions in Crimea, Eastern Ukraine, and Syria?
I have to start by clearly saying I don't read Cyrillic, so I don't read Russian. And I haven't been to what today is called the Russian Federation since the 1980s. So the last time I was there, it was still the Soviet Union.
Right.
And I made a number of visits to Moscow and Leningrad in the 1980s. Mm. A week, something like that. Mm-hmm. So in terms of what I know about Russia, there's a brick wall against which I will run up to. Now, I say this because I think it's very important when people talk about Russia that they're honest about what they know. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how many experts about Russia have suddenly appeared on the scene in the last couple of years. Who are these people? Now, some of them are genuine experts who know Russian, who know the Russians, who spent time out there, who read the language, who know the culture, mm-hmm. And have some understanding. But actually, if you look very closely, these are pretty few and far between. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of the so-called experts writing about Russia today, what the hell do they know about it? I think the answer is very, very little. And a lot of them, I think, are just replicating and repeating what they're being told by other people. Again, doesn't mean they're wrong. I'm going to keep saying that. But I think we should view what they have to say with extreme caution and skepticism. So, with that caveat out the way, how do we view what Russia's been doing in Syria? I'm not sure Obama's red line in, was it 2013, is necessarily the best place to start. I think, actually, if you look at Russian behaviour today, and perhaps we might add Chinese, and we might also add Iranian in there, maybe also Saudi Arabian. Yeah, I don't think 2013 is where it started.
No, indeed.
As a historian, and we were talking about comparisons earlier, I think if historians and people want evidence from historians about where to look for earlier examples of how to understand Russian behaviour today, you don't look to 1914 or indeed 1917. You don't look to 1938 or 1939. You don't look to 1945, or we could go on with a list of dates. You get the idea.
Indeed.
I think we want to look at the period between 1989 and, say, 2000, 2001.
Okay.
It's the 1990s. And I think this is an interesting area because this is an area where you do have some research from historians. I think there's some very interesting work being done on the end of the Cold War in the 1990s and early 1980s and early 1990s. Yeah, some of these materials are being released. The discussions between Reagan and Gorbachev, between the first President Bush, for example, Margaret Thatcher, John Major, so on and so forth, Helmut Kohl, Schmidt and others. There's some interesting work coming out. But it's also a period that's at an intersection between those people studying international relations, political science, looking backwards, and those historians. So there's an intersection here. I think the 1990s is an interesting area because it's multidisciplinary. Yeah. But I don't think enough work has been done on what were the repercussions for the end of the Cold War on Russian and or post-Soviet Russian thinking. I think there's some interesting, and I think this is a key issue, the tricky question about NATO's eastward expansion.
Yes.
Yeah. What was agreed to, what wasn't agreed to, whether it was a good idea, whether it was a bad idea. Whether anyone should care how the Kremlin sees the expansion of NATO. I think the view in Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and perhaps elsewhere today is, thank God we did join NATO when we did. What sort of position would we be in today without Article 5 protection?
Yeah, yeah.
And one finds it difficult looking at Ukraine not to agree with them. But there's also the question of how Moscow perceived the 1990s. And I think this is where what Putin says about this is quite interesting. Not to take what he says at face value.
No,
of course. I think someone like Andrew Moynihan, who's working at Chatham House, I think his work is very interesting on this. And certainly someone who I would read on the subject as opposed to some other people who are writing about it. Again, I'm not automatically saying that everything Andrew writes is gospel truth, but I find it more interesting and more nuanced than a lot of people are writing. Is that if we're trying to understand Moscow's behaviour today and Moscow's perception of the world, then I think a lot of the bases and foundations of that perception are to be found in the 1990s. And I think we have to have an understanding of that perception in order to understand current behaviour. Not to excuse it in any way.
Indeed.
Not to defend it in any way. I think the seizure of Crimea, it's quite clear what that is. I don't think that needs to be explained or excused. But a comprehension, otherwise it would go down this route of, well, Putin's ex-KGB, he's evil, they're trying to resurrect the Soviet Union.
It's a possibility.
This makes me raise my eyebrows. It may well be the case. Maybe that's the plan they're working to. But I'm not entirely convinced of that. Yeah, I mean, it's a nice, neat summary. I mean, we heard this before in the 1930s. We heard this before in 1945.
Yes.
And it's not always the case that the evidence backs this up.
In the case of Stalin, yeah.
I think there's still quite a healthy debate about exactly what Stalin was trying to do between 1945 and 1948, 1949. What exactly was the policy in Central and Eastern Europe in that period? In 1979, it's interesting to note how many people thought the Soviet Union was heading for the Persian Gulf when it went into Afghanistan. Well, doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence for that sort of thinking in the Politburo at the time. In fact, their primary concern seemed to be radical Islam in the 1970s and 1980s. Okay. So I think one has to comprehend, not to excuse or defend contemporary Russian foreign policy, but to comprehend. And I think this is something, and I keep coming back to this, is one thinks of what Robert S. McNamara had to say for himself in Errol Morris's documentary, The Fog of War. You know, here's a very intelligent bunch of chaps and chapesses working in the early 1960s for President Kennedy, quite convinced of their scientific ability and their predictive ability, based on mathematics and science. Yeah, we know what's going on in the Soviet Union. We know what they're trying to do in North Vietnam. We know what this Mr. Ho Chi Minh is up to. But they didn't. They fundamentally misunderstood. And I think this came to the fore and came to light again very recently with the death of Fidel Castro. And the wide variety of different approaches to what Castro was. Of course, you had many articles and many people writing that, well, thank God this murderous dictator was now dead. The Cuban people will now know freedom once again. Maybe they will. But on the other hand, there were many people who jumped to his defense. The
Corbyns of the world.
And
wonderful education programs.
Yeah, wonderful education, health care. Sure, he murdered a few people, locked a few people up, but he liberated from the Cuban people from the Batista regime. I think what I found interesting about this, and I think some other people noted this as well, I'm certainly not going to say it was my view, is this cleavage between an understanding of what I would call a European Cold War and an understanding of what I would call a global Cold War. And that a lot of what I read about Putin and Russia today is very much, and this is a phrase I'm quite keen on, very much directed and directed through the lens of geographical myopia.
I see where you're keen on it.
It is about experiences of Central and Eastern Europe in the short 20th century being projected forward. A European Cold War of Soviet aggression, of Soviet occupation, of Soviet repression, and in cases, mass murder. And that this is the lens where Russia is being viewed via, perfectly understandably. Whereas there's a different lens that
one has to look at Cuba through. And that's a lens of the global Cold War and the understanding of the global Cold War. And this is something that Odd Arndt Westad, Professor Westad, formerly of the LSC, again, not my idea, he sets this forward in his book, The Global Cold War, talking about, well, actually, we need to add decolonization into the mix of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And if you ignore decolonization, then you don't understand the Cold War. Mm. And one of my concerns of the view of Russia today emanating from Central and Eastern Europe is that it's a blinkered view, perfectly understandable view, but it's certainly not a global view. Mm. It's a view of the experiences, the terrible experiences of Soviet repression in Central and Eastern Europe in the 20th century. And yet we have to remember, not defend or excuse, but remember globally, communism and the Soviet Union in parts of the Caribbean, Latin and South America, in Africa, in the Far East, was not regarded as an evil, repressive, genocidal, totalitarian empire, but as a beacon of liberty for the dispossessed and the colonially occupied. And it's that dimension that I think is very important. And it always strikes me, this differentiation to this view. Yeah? And as someone who travelled behind the Iron Curtain in the 70s and 80s and was lucky enough to travel fairly widely in the Caribbean and certain parts of Latin America in the same period, always strikes me that one side doesn't get the other side. And there's this real cleavage in our understanding of the legacy. And there is a legacy of the Cold War. I wouldn't completely ignore it. Mm-hmm. But it's a complex legacy. Mm. And this simplistic Putin is Stalin, Putin is Hitler, today's Russian. I mean, we can see this in the way in which people conflate Russian Federation and Soviet Union, as if these terms are interchangeable. Mm. Today's Russia is not the Soviet Union. I mean, it's capitalist.
A peculiar form of capitalism, maybe, but it's capitalist. Mm. It's certainly not communist. Mm. I mean, you can see the resurgence of Russian Orthodoxy there. Mm. You know, how genuine this is, I'm not sure I'm qualified to talk about. But you wouldn't have expected to see Khrushchev or Brezhnev wandering around with a Russian Orthodox priest behind them blessing missiles.
Indeed.
Yeah? This is fundamentally different. Yeah? And I think if you conflate these experiences, you're on a dangerous track. Again, I understand why people do it. Mm. It makes for good headlines. It's something that people understand. But this is political rhetoric. Mm. It is not intellectual comprehension. Mm. And I understand the purpose of that propaganda. But as a historian, I'm not sure I can buy into it in that way. Mm.